Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books.
Kia ora, welcome to Bookends with Mary-Ann Stone and Morin Rout. And today we're looking at one of the most important books that's come onto the literary scene in Aotearoa this year. It's called The Valley. It's by Asher Emanuel, and it looks at crime and punishment in a New Zealand city. It's the culmination of over 2 years of field research and hundreds of hours of interviews in the Hutt Valley. And I think it's not just worthy of reading, but Mary-Ann has done a wonderful job of talking to Asher about how he came to write the book. I'm also talking with novelist Dominic Hoey, who's come to live in Otatahi for now and has started up writing classes and is keen to let people know that there are spaces available in one of his slots. I'm also keen to know how he's finding life down here in the cold. And I'm also talking with Claudia from Scorpio about what people are buying and reading from the shop.
Asher Emanuel spent 8 years bringing The Valley, Crime and Punishment in a New Zealand City, from concept into the hands of readers. It is being received as nationally important, a once-in-a-generation contribution to discussion on justice in Aotearoa, and as a virtuosic writing achievement. Why the superlatives? Emanuel excavates a layered story from the daily grind of ordinary people in our criminal justice system. By ordinary, I mean people like us, if we had to walk in their shoes. And I mean not people who commit headline-grabbing crimes. This is a book about petty criminals and those who represent and work with them. It is a book that allows us to feel the weight and value of each ordinary life and hopefully to find the resolve to do better justice to our shared humanity. He joins me this morning. Tēnā koe, Asher. I'm very excited to talk with you about your book on our show.
Tēnā koe, Mary-Ann. Thanks for having me.
Cool. So I want to start by asking about you. You dedicate the book to your dad, and I want to know what that might tell us about how Asher Emanuel came to write this book.
Well, yeah, my family and I think, like you say about the book, it's a book about ordinary people and the kind of things that are going on in the lives of Nathan and Rekihana and Lewis, who are the main figures in the valley, are things that there will be few people in New Zealand who don't have a connection to someone who's faced some of those issues or challenges before. My father, I dedicated the book to him. He's always encouraged me and been a supporter of me. And it felt right to me to dedicate it to him.
Is he part of your moral compass, your dad?
Certainly. We learn so much from our parents, and the way my father is with people in the world and who he is as a person has been important to, I guess, who I am, and who I am in a quiet way has shaped this book.
Yeah, for sure. So now, on to Nathan and Ricky Hannah and Lewis, right? Tell listeners about those three, how they became your subjects, and how they're in some ways emblematic of the New Zealand city of the title.
Nathan and Ricky Hannah are, at the start of the book, in trouble once more, facing charges in the Hutt Valley District Court. Nathan's criminal history is lots of burglaries, and Ricky Hannah is, his MO is more shoplifting. And then Lewis is their defence lawyer, and the three of them, they're a similar age to me. We were all born late 80s, early 90s, millennials, at the end of a political era in this country, and have lived our lives in the new New Zealand that came out of the political changes at the end of the 80s and in the early 90s. They came to be the book came to be about those three, not through design. The whole project had taken 8 years from contract to shelf, but the field research was about 2 years, and in the course of that, I met many people, and followed many cases, and it was only towards the end of the research that the coherence of that trio became clearer to me. And some of that was to do with the way that they, the rapport that they had with one another, because of the aspects of experience that they shared, being of a similar age. All three of them were from and grew up in the Hutt Valley. And in a different life, they might have been friends had they not had a lawyer-client relationship. And Nathan and Ricky Hannah knew each other from an earlier phase of their life, where they'd been neighbours at one point, and occasionally they come across one another when they are both in prison.
Yeah, so three young men who grew up in the valley, right? And I guess the story is kind of is typical across Aotearoa criminal justice, I imagine, in many ways. But your scholarly rigor wouldn't quite let you get away with that in the name of the book. So you have to be really specific about this a New Zealand city. It's not just kind of in Aotearoa; it's in this particular place. What's endemic in it? That to the valley? What's specific to the valley?
Well, there's a note a few pages in, on I think on the eighth page, that concludes that this is a story found in courtrooms and communities across New Zealand. And so the subtitle, A New Zealand City, does have a specificity to it, and then there is the title, but it is emblematic. There are aspects of the Hutt Valley in its sort of in its geography and its connection to the Wellington region that I think are part of the historical backdrop to what's happening in the lives of Nathan and Ricky Hannah and Lewis. That it used to be the industrial heart of the region, and a place where there was a lot of, you know, there were Nai Nai and so on had been a model state housing community, and in many ways this is a place that represented the some of the high point of the, you know, the 20th century for working New Zealanders. And in the same way, the dismantling of the productive base there,
yeah, and
the dismantling of the state is particularly manifest there and is visible there, but is by no means unique to the Hutt Valley and something which has taken place right across the country.
Yeah, for sure. So the plot gets a lot of its momentum, right, from the various barriers that keep making it harder for these guys to find traction on the treacherous slope of their life paths, you know. You've described those constant barriers as a symptom of that breakdown you just mentioned, the breakdown across all of the social support systems that our heroes interact with, right? There are many excellent examples of how those barriers just keep, you know, throwing up another one because of the breakdown of the system. But can you pick just a few to paint that picture for our listeners? So from the lives of Ricky Hana or Nathan, just show how that system breakdown keeps preventing them getting traction.
One of the lasting impressions for me from researching and writing this book is the way in which the criminal justice system is not something separate to and apart from the rest of life and society. And that's part of why, talking on the previous question, I spoke to those broader economic and historical changes. And one thing I think the Valley illustrates over and over again is the relationship between the criminal justice system and, say, housing or criminal justice system and the public health system. And for instance, the way in which the changes in the criminal justice system, such as the bail law reforms and the increased use of pretrial detention, interact with increasingly expensive and unavailable private rental accommodation and the unavailability of appropriate accommodation for people facing the kind of challenges that Nathan and Ricky Hana are facing. So at one point in the book, Ricky Hana is arrested on a Friday afternoon for shoplifting. And because he's been trespassed from that supermarket, that shoplifting is charged as a burglary rather than a theft under $500. And the maximum penalty for those is very different. A maximum penalty for a burglary is many years of prison. And the other consequence of that is that it triggers certain provisions under the Bail Act because of the length of his criminal history and because he'd been charged with a burglary, which counts as a serious property offence. It means that come Saturday morning, the Justice of the Peace, who's sitting at the court, doesn't have jurisdiction to grant him bail. And so he has to wait until Monday or Tuesday for there to be a judge sitting and a list to hear the bail application. And as a result of this, he goes to Rimutaka prison for the weekend. And while he's in Rimutaka prison, the Department of Corrections informs the Ministry of Social Development that they have Ricky Hana Wallace in custody, and MSD cuts off his benefit, which means the boarding house where he's been living and which was secured at considerable difficulty and effort on part of his lawyer and a bail support officer, the rent stops being paid. And so when he does eventually get granted bail on the Tuesday morning, now subject to, I think it might be a 24-hour curfew, or he has much more restrictive bail conditions, he then gets into the situation where he's breaching his bail conditions to go down to the WINS office to reconnect the benefit so that the rent will be paid to the boarding house where he's staying. And so it's just the ways in which a small calamity can escalate and become so destructive in a life like Ricky Hana's is something that is the valley, this kind of taking this long view of what happens for these guys over the course of a year and a half, that's visible.
That's right, and that it is very visible. Thank you. And because that little episode there that just took you a good concerted time to condense for us is actually just one time. That's a weekend of the 2 years of your research, a weekend of their life where this just keeps happening and happening, right? And it goes on from there, that episode, and it is agonizing reading. listeners. Despite that breakdown, though, you show us individuals across that system, especially when he does get into wins there, who I take it they're representative of people working across those systems. Generally, they're people with professionalism, generosity. Jean and T at the Wins office, Deborah and other parts of the judiciary operating the special court. All of those people, you know, whom we respect and admire in the book, you know, along with our heroes. What do you want the reader to take from the example of all those other people in the system, all the bit players who are maintaining their humanity in an inhumane system?
Well, it was very important for me that the book depict the place of workers in the criminal justice system as well, and the impact of that work on them. And two things come to mind. The first is that I think in crime writing, fiction or nonfiction, there are these template narratives, ideas, forms, story forms that we have. Cops and robbers, you know, villains, heroes. We've been speaking of the heroes. And it could be easy to slip into one of those templates and trying to tell the story. And I've really tried to hew as close to reality as possible, even when that means there's aspects which could be narratively disappointing and so on, because I think we risk with those stories a mystification of what the actual relationships are and what the system is. And so, you know, it is my impression that just about everybody in there, in their different roles, is doing their best. And moreover, that those same historical processes that are affecting Nathan and Rekihana out in the world are affecting the justice sector workers who are public servants working in this institution, which as a result of decades of austerity and privatisation has been tasked with doing more and more with less and less, but being staffed by public service-minded people in all of these different roles. Just like in health, just like in our schools, people have papered over the cracks by doing more themselves, and it's coming at their expense as well. And so the impact of the system on Lewis, but also on the judges, you know, the judge that we meet in one of the chapters, and on Deborah Andrews, the lawyer who sort of leads the special circumstances court. That's a very important part of the story to me as well.
Yeah. I mean, what that made me think about all those people was we all have to live with ourselves, right? And but as you say, you know, if you just keep the erosion going, the best of people can't paper over all of the cracks and broken systems. Yeah. Talking about all those other characters, you mentioned Judge Wallace the chapter complex presentation that starts part four, right? Why, which is about exactly halfway in the book. And I wanted to ask you why that chapter sits there at the centre of the book, if you like.
It's a chapter that had moved around in the structure, which is otherwise broadly a chronology. And it is, each chapter begins with a date that tells us where it is, and most of those are purely chronological. And Complex Presentations, chapter 18, is broadly in its chronological position there. At the start of part four. At times I'd thought about presenting it as a series of vignettes throughout the book. But I think in the end it fits there at that inflection point in the story where we've been moving in a way further and further in to the system. We've been becoming closer to the main figures, and that part starts in the judge's chambers at the very centre of the operation. And there's a kind of a quietness there that is a moment of, I guess, relief from what's been taking place in the narrative so far, but also takes us, I think, to a new and possibly unanticipated vantage. And one of the people who read the book in manuscript form, who has spent a lot of time in court and who's very familiar with the impact of the criminal justice system in other parts of the state on defendants and complainants and so on, said that they had not before, despite all of that time spent in court, really thought about what the impact of all of this was on the judges, because they're up there on the bench in the robe, so inscrutable and poker-faced that you can easily forget that there's a person there too who bears the weight of the responsibility to decide.
Mm, yeah. And the decision-making, actually how much room there is for decision-making. There's a point at which in the book it talks about how decisions change over the course of a career. I can't quite remember where that happens, but whether it's in that chapter, but it was an interesting reflection. Look, it should be obvious by now to listeners that this isn't a light read, right? Actually, even though you've stripped it back to reveal the story to us, it's kind of the point that we still have to labour through the mess alongside these three to find whatever meaning that we're going to be able to take out from it all. We have to go through it to some extent. Can you talk about that process, though, that pairing it back, the working out what was needed, how much you had to cut, even once you'd zeroed in on these characters? You know, it'd be interesting to know just how, what, even when you had these characters as your three centerpieces, how much transcript you had, because it's all from recorded stuff, right?
Mm-hmm. In my notes, my overall notes were, I think, something close to 900,000 words worth of material. The first draft of the book, the manuscript was 220,000 words, and the final product is something closer to 140,000, 150,000 words. So a significant amount. It has been a process of reduction and compression. And the way that I went about that, I drafted it just in pure chronology and wrote it all up, the story of the three of them and the bits and pieces which happen around the sides, because there's the three of them, but there's many other people in the book as well. And it was at that point that I was able to look at the whole and think about what was serving the understanding of the events of those years. And one of the characteristic parts of their story is repetition. They're back again and they're back again, and it's another bail hearing, or you know, we're at the scene at Wynn's, and it's a 2.5 hour meeting, and it's typified by boredom and frustration and futility. And the difficulty is that boredom, frustration, and futility are not very good literary devices, and have to be used very sparingly. So you're caught between the desire to represent that reality and the demands of narrative nonfiction to bring the reader along and keep them connected with the story and with the people, because if you lose the reader, then what is the point? So I looked for the repetition and and would condense into retellings and compress whole months into some sentences or a paragraph in order to bring it down to size.
Yeah. Look, we're going to run out of time, which is sad. But to me, that how much work it took, it felt like a bit of a metaphor, right? To that if it takes that much work just to reveal the story in a way that's going to keep readers engaged, then how much work will it take to fix everything that's broken? You have a sense of that when you read the book, that this is, if we want to engage with fixing it, it's going to be a big job. So my final question is, are you hopeful?
The way I've described my feeling about the process on this front is that I've found it clarifying. And, you know, what's the old saying? Pessimism of the intellect and optimism of the will, you know. But in between, you know, in between the question of pessimism, optimism, hope and despair, there is for me importance in clarifying the problem. And this comes back to what we were talking about before with the way in which narrative might mystify and keep us away from the truth. In the same way, the way in which news media systematically is unable to represent the reality of the criminal justice system keeps us away from the truth of what's happening in our society and why it's happening. And so for me, part of the work of the Valley is getting up close to those processes. And yes, it's a book about individuals, but it's more, I think, a book about history and the way in which these individuals try time and again and struggle to put a dent in, you know, the huge obstacles that they face, and they're swept up in these forces larger than themselves. And of course, there's room for the vagaries of individual destiny around that, and you never know when people's lives suddenly take a huge turn. But when you step back and see the pattern over the 18 months, there is a huge pattern to what's happening here, and it's the revealing of that pattern that's important to me. That the individuals might try, but the solution ultimately has to be a collective one at the level of politics and the old political questions of who gets what. And these are, I think, not actually such complicated political issues, but they are very contentious and they are hard. And perhaps for that reason, there's a desire to look away and go in search of silver bullets and new policy ideas or reorganisations or a change to this law or that law. But I think when you get to the end of the valley, it was at least apparent to me that the problem was larger than that, but also in some ways more straightforward.
We need to wrap it up. Let's hope that we have a different history to tell and before too much longer. And thank you very much, Usha. And ngā mihi nui to everyone who shared their story with you so you could share them with us. I've been speaking with Usha Emmanuel about his book, The Valley, Crime and Punishment in New Zealand City. It's published by new publisher Bridget Williams Books. It's available everywhere. Read it, talk about it, ask your MP to read it. It's time that we did something different.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Writer Dominic Coe has moved to Otatahi, and I read somewhere, Dominic, that you wanted to get a taste of seasonal depression.
I don't know about that. I feel like I had enough seasonal depression.
And I was just thinking, well, we haven't done a very good job of getting you into that state.
Oh, no, it's plenty cold.
It's cold enough for you?
Yeah, I know everyone's wearing T-shirts and shorts, but I'm freezing.
Well, it's a problem with growing up in the tropical north, isn't it?
Yeah, no, I've got the Auckland blood, so I've got to acclimatise myself.
Yeah, well, I here was me thinking that these days and days of sunshine were going to prevent you feeling this. But anyway, it's lovely to have you down here, and you're not just sitting around trying to write a book. You're out there doing things in the community. So
Yes, I'm teaching a couple of weekly classes on Monday and Tuesday at Te Wā. Tuesday's full, but Monday still has some spots, and I thought I'd try and get the word out a bit more, you know?
Well, thank you for coming here and doing it. Now, Te Wā, I had to look that up. I should know about it, but tell me more.
Yes, yeah, so it's this incredible art space that's set up that, it's predominantly set up for Māori and tangata moana and also LGBTQ+ artists. And then also people like myself get to go and, like, rent it as well. And it's sort of predominantly free, and it's for people to do experimental work. It's a huge space in Sydenham.
Sydenham,
that's how you say it. And there's all, there's people producing music. There's a tattoo studio there. There's me doing my thing there. I've actually been writing the novel there as well. So I've got my big bit of cardboard with the post-it notes and the plot and stuff, and yeah, it's cool. It's a really vibrant place.
Good. And it's warm enough?
It is. Well, it's got a heat pump, so I've been cranking that, you know.
You don't feel you have to take your duvet with you to do it?
Not yet, but I guess it's not even winter. Is it winter
yet? No.
It's going to get colder.
Well, it should be, but no, we can turn the thermostat down here.
I remember last time I was here, last time I came up and talked to you, and then and it was so cold. I remember going outside and I couldn't breathe. I was just like, it was brutal.
Well, I'm glad that you've found this warm and welcoming place. So your writing classes, who needs to come?
Yeah, so it's open to everyone. Like, we've got everyone from people that are completely green, you know, that are just starting writing, and there's people in there that are professional writers. And because my philosophy is, like, it doesn't matter where you're at. You know, I've been writing for 30 years, and, like, you know, when I get into that kind of environment, I'm always learning. I mean, you know, so, and how it works is, you know, every week a different person will share some writing and everyone sort of feeds back, and then we sort of look at different craft, you know. So the first sort of 6 weeks we were looking at poetry, now we're looking at the short story, and all the class are actually writing stories to enter the Sargeson competition.
Good.
Yeah, and it's like, it's just a really nice community feel. And I think as writers, we're so often alone that I think having that community and being inspired by each other, because this is something I did in Auckland for years, and it was really awesome. You'll sort of see this writer is suddenly take some ideas from this person and vice versa, and then suddenly everyone's, you know, cross-pollinating and getting published and stuff too, which is obviously really gratifying.
Because, you know, there's always been controversy over whether you can teach people to write or not, and that can put people off going to classes like this because they feel they should, you know, have some kind of either vocation or have proved themselves in some way. But it sounds to me like you're saying, come.
Totally. I think that's totally really crazy to me that people say you can't teach it, because, I mean, I personally had no natural aptitude towards it at all. You know, now I've written like 3 best-selling novels, and I think that you need that solid base of craft, and those things are all teachable, and most of it's not rocket science. You know, like, I could teach someone like a metaphor, how to edit their work in 15, 20 minutes, you know. But it does take, I think, time to work out how to teach that and to get the right examples and exercises. And I think that a lot of creative writing classes, it's more just everyone kind of sharing, and there's not that real nuance, I think, towards craft, you know. So I think that's where this is kind of different.
Yes, yeah, because it sounds like you are giving them a good grounding in craft.
Totally. And I share all my gold, like I share all my secrets, you know, which a lot of writers I know don't do that when they're teaching. They get funny about that. But I'm like, you know, the more good writers we have, the better. And it's not like just if I show someone how, you know, I construct my prose, for example, it's not like they're going to be able to write like me. Well, if they can, that's my problem because I should, you know what I mean? I've been doing it for 30 years. I should be able to keep ahead, you know. So, yeah, so that's kind of the philosophy behind it.
Well, that's good because I agree with you. The more writers there are out there, the better.
Totally.
Especially for readers like me. I'm hungry for good writing.
Yeah, and so many of the best stories are, you know, are with people that aren't probably going to go to uni or might not feel comfortable in a traditional kind of night class. But it's really important that we get those stories out there. And so I think that's another reason why I started this, or probably the main reason why I started this as well. So, you know, for people listening that might be a bit whakamā or be like, oh, I don't know if this is for me. I mean, it really is. There's everyone there, you know, there's young people and older people and there's people from all different backgrounds and different levels of education and stuff. So, yeah, and that's what's really exciting about it too.
Good. I guess we better give people some actual details about where to come and what time and what they need to bring.
Yeah, so it's 6:30 to 8 every Monday, and all you need to bring is whatever you like to write with. So if people want to sign up, they can either email me. So my email is hello@dominichoey.com, which is my name, or just find me on social media, which is also just my name, Dominic Hoey. Just message me. And then I also have a learntowritegood.co.nz website where you can message me off that as well.
Easy to get in touch.
Yes. Yes.
Easy to come along.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I say, it really is open to everyone.
It sounds just the right thing for somebody who's on the brink of, and as you say, once people get into that writing community, they can really flourish.
Yeah, and you just don't know where it's going to take you to, you know? Like, yeah. If someone would have told me when I started rapping how long ago, you know, that I'd end up doing poetry and novels and stuff, I mean, I would have wanted to do those things, but it would have seemed crazy. And I think, you know, like in Auckland, like so many of the people that I've worked with and taught, I mean, the stuff they've gone on to do has been really incredible, you know.
So we can expect great things from you. But the good thing is people can just come along because
they want to have fun, yeah.
Yeah,
totally,
yeah.
Exactly. And I think that there's, you know, like the other thing I always say to my students is having that base of craft, you know, you might be like, okay, I'm going to write poetry. And so you learn poetry craft, but then you decide to write a screenplay and it's actually quite similar and it's quite easy to transition. So once you have that base, you can transition through all different sort of creative fields. And that's another really great thing about it.
A good writer can turn their hand to so many things, can't they? And as you say, it can lead, give people this amazing self-confidence and
totally,
and attack things that they would never have thought possible.
Yeah, yeah. It's so exciting. I mean, I love it when someone comes in and they're like, oh, I don't really know, da, da, da. And then, like, you know, a few months later and they're like, oh, I've submitted this to this thing or I've published this here, you know, and they're really excited about what they've done. And, yeah, and like I say, I just think the more stories we have out there from different people and different backgrounds, the better.
Yep, you're preaching to the converted here, Dominic. And I hope being down here is being productive for your own work. Cause
yeah, yeah, I'm sort of maybe, I reckon, like halfway through the new book. So I've got to the end of the year. So, yeah.
Have you given yourself that timetable?
Oh, no, my publisher has given me that timetable. But that's all good. I think I like having a deadline, you know, otherwise it's easy to sort of fluff around.
I bet. And have we got you for a long time or a short time?
Yeah, well, I think I'll be here at least because I signed a year-long lease, so I guess I'll be here to the end of that. And I've got no plans to leave, so, yeah, I'm enjoying it. I love how you can walk places, you know.
Yeah.
It's really novel after, because I was in Titirangi in Auckland, so.
And it's a long walk into the centre of the city from there.
So I like just pottering around, you know. And again, being part of that sort of te wā and wider arts community, is really exciting too, you know.
I'm glad we've welcomed you in. It's great to have people come and be part of what's going on down here.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you. No, it's nice being here.
Well, I hope people will flock to your classes, Dominic, and exciting to have you here, as I say. And I hope we can entice you to stay longer.
Yeah, thanks so much.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Claudia from Scorpio is here, our wonderful sponsors, and we've already had a rave up about the birthday party and the fact that Scorpio is 50. I can imagine in another 50 years it's, well, I like to imagine that there are still bookshops in whatever form cities take or the world takes, but that's, I think that's a whole conversation for another day. But Claudia's going to tell us what people are buying and what they should be looking out for in fiction. Now, here's a very particular request. My daughter sent a message to me yesterday saying she needed some fiction recommendations. She lives in Australia, so I can't really give her New Zealand ones, or I could, but what's a couple of fiction recommendations?
Ooh, it's quite a good time for, what do we call it, like top shelf new fiction releases. One on my list is The Things We Never Say by Elizabeth Strout. So Elizabeth Strout, author of Olive Kitteridge, big seller in the literary fiction about human things, about relationships, about families, but with a good eye for great prose. Belle absolutely loved Things We Never Say by Elizabeth Strout, and I find that Belle's taste on this area of fiction is pretty solid. You can't really fault it. She called it a poignant window into the deep grief and disillusionment many Americans are feeling right now. So it's quite a contemporary novel. It's set in Trumpian America, and it's about a professor who's trying to kind of keep in touch with his current wave of students, but finding constantly that just sort of there are stumbling blocks he can't quite get past. And across the board, reviews of this book have been rave. Ron Charles, who's an independent reviewer, said that it's almost like a collage, a series of short passages, sometimes just three or four lines, but the effect is impressionistic, but provides the gentlest forward momentum. So I think this book is going to be a smash hit, and even in the last month, we've sold stacks of it. It's only a slender novel, so you can't get intimidated by it. Can't pull that one. But I think, well, that could be the kind of thing your daughter might be after.
I have to say that I did get a copy sent to me, and I've been a fan of hers for a very long time, and it's up there with her very best. And that's saying a lot, because she writes excellent books. So I absolutely concur with everybody, with what everybody's saying about it.
Yeah. I haven't actually gotten to Elizabeth Strout myself, but I think I know when I do, I'm going to enjoy it. So, in a funny sort of way that makes me not want to rush.
She'll be there waiting.
That's right. And speaking of other, you know, literary heavy hitters, John of John by Stuart Douglas. This is the author of Shaggy Bane, which I believe was one of the very few debut authors to win the Booker Prize. So, I mean, imagine the pressure to come up with something so great as your second book. But the reviews of John of John have been fantastic. I've just grabbed myself the reading copy. I'm quite excited to get into it. The New York Book Review, Mark Harris, said, "It's moving, suspenseful, completely worth your time. A stick of dynamite waiting to go off in your hand."
Woo.
Yeah.
What?
Indeed. I mean, how often do they say that about a novel? So that one, I mean, speaking of sticks of dynamite, I'm currently really enjoying London Falling by Patrick Radden Keefe, which has been our nonfiction bestseller for the month. Just spin after spin, you know, you don't see them coming. And the way he gets into the background of every single, I mean, I want to call them characters, but they're real people. It's nonfiction. The way he gets into the background of every single person who's involved, it's just fantastic. You find yourself learning so much about the world, though you think you're just hearing the story of one teenage boy's passing, you know? So big up from me on that one. also in international nonfiction, still selling really well. We have Famesick by Lena Dunham. This prompted me to go on a bit of a, you know, a little fossick, because I think last time we talked, I'd mentioned it and I hadn't really engaged with much Lena Dunham. We started watching Girls. and I got to say, I'm liking it. So I'm probably going to give Dunham a chance on this one and check this book out. And then in terms of, well, so as part of our birthday celebrations, I'll tangent to New Zealand fiction. We did this, we have our Inklings that's come out for the winter. This is our biannual catalogue of titles that we, Scorpio staff, curate and select. And inside this particular winter version of Inklings, we've done an A3 insert to celebrate the 50th. One side is a quite cool commemorative poster of vintage ads for Scorpio Books. The other side is a list of backlist book titles that keep selling. So these are dog-eared favourites from over the decades. And we ordered a couple of these books for the shop floor thinking, you know, a lot of people already have these books. They're classics, but we want to, you know, kind of, we want to honour the books that have helped the business last so long. And lots of them have just been selling really well. So Owe by Becky Manawa Tu is on there. We've almost sold all of that floor stock. Likewise, Portugy by Patricia Grace Adams. And The Luminaries by Eleanor Catton, which I just assumed that everybody in New Zealand owned by now, but maybe not quite. And then in terms of more recent New Zealand fiction, of course, The Ockham Winner, All Her Lives by Ingrid Horrocks. Selling stacks of that at the moment. One of my colleagues gave it a go after it won the Acorn, and she came into the office and said, look, I've actually got quite a lot of time for this book. It's kind of quiet, it's reserved, but it's women living their lives. It's stories that maybe aren't so flashy and high-powered, but the prose is actually really lovely to sit with and reflect on. So there you go. If you want a sort of slightly more mellow book after reading the thrilling account of London Falling by Patrick Radden Keith, maybe All Her Lives would be a nice sort of tonic.
Yeah, no, they're beautifully crafted stories and, you know, in a real variety of things. But, you know, also looking at Mary Shelley in several of the stories, and I think, you know, that whole Frankenstein, Dracula thing never dies, does it?
Yeah, and on that topic, we're starting to take orders for Stakes by Noelle McCarthy, right? This is her next her next fiction book. This is the author of Grand. And I believe that is influenced by Dracula too, right?
Yeah, I'm halfway through it at the moment, and ooh, I'm feeling like I have to go and have a look into Dracula. I'm one of the few people who's never been taken by the vampire.
Oh, Morin, I love Dracula. That's a
I know. I feel I feel like I've missed a huge step somewhere in my literary upbringing.
And if you ever get the chance to go to real life Whitby, the town where Dracula first came ashore in England. Oh, it's fabulous. I've just never seen a place that's so strongly gives you that sense of being in the world of the book that is set, I don't know, it's the ruined abbey and the little sort of the town hunched on the cliff. It was just fantastic, yeah.
Well, Stakes, yes. I will be, it's the sort of book of the month, I think, in some regards. So many people will be hanging out for it and grabbing a copy of it. So I hope you've got a big pile there.
I believe they're on the way, yes. Would you like to hear the New Zealand nonfiction top picks as well?
Yes, please.
So we have in the top spot One Last Question, Prime Minister by Barry Soper. Is that how I say his last
name? Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's how you say it.
I'm not very familiar with Barry, and I've heard some mixed reviews about this book. Some people, I think, feel he was a bit uneven with his treatment of Jacinda Ardern, but Lyric Wywoody Smith for the spin-off wrote a great review talking about how it does seem to sort of evoke this golden age of press around politics that lots of younger reporters today kind of think, you know, oh, maybe that was the time when it was really great to be like doing this job. And now, you know, have we just got the dregs left at the moment? You know, the sort of the way that lots of us sort of feel about the industries we're in, like, you know, maybe the golden age has already been. But also at the same time, Lyric acknowledged that it's actually quite good to see more of New Zealand's society reflected in its representatives. And I think what Lyric touched on in the book that it sounds the most appealing to me is this idea that Barry sort of looks at the careers of these prime ministers, each chapter is a different prime minister, and indicates that, you know, these were people trying to do their best and there was no guidebook on how to be the perfect prime minister. They were figuring it out. So it's quite a humanising portrayal, I think, of the prime ministers at the centre of the narrative. Of course, I need to mention The Valley by Asha Emanuel. This book is the culmination of years of field research. Lots of it is verbatim dialogue. It's an up-close and personal account of lawyers and criminals in the Hutt Valley. I have the reading copy at the moment. I'm getting into it. It's if you're into sort of true crime books that don't go too hard on the ghoulish kind of slightly concerning aspects of true crime, and it's more about the sort of the law and the systems and the way that it lets people down, this is the book for you. And it's just told in such a fantastic, engaging but not too sort of heavy-handed or emotive style. You are left to sort of piece the dots. I'm confusing my metaphors. You're left to connect the dots.
Yeah. Yeah, boy, it's, you know, people have just taken it up and it's had a remarkable ride through its public, you know, being published and being accepted and taken on.
Which I think is a really good sign because, BWB have been making great books for a long time and they're always so well researched and so robust. So I'm quite happy to see this book kind of come shining through right from the outset. And he made such a great splash at Auckland Writers Festival. I mean, yeah, sorry to bring up PRK again, but imagine being a debut author and your first panel event at Auckland Writers Festival is with Patrick Radden Keith.
Yeah. I know. And more than holding your own, I understand.
That's right. Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
Tremendous.
Hmm.
So that's those are the top picks and plenty of good books to get into, regardless of what your penchant is. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Claudia. Winter awaits. Go and get your books from Scorpio.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books. Next Tuesday on Plains Media.